trade exchanges between Iran and Iraq are currently carried out via the road connection, and so also the massive flow of pilgrims throughout the year to the holy shrines located in either country, with only a small percentage using the airways. Once the Shalamche-Basra railway is complete, this would greatly benefit the two sides, both economically and commercially, in view of the fact that Iraq could be virtually connected to a transcontinental network extending all the way up to China, while Iran can help its western neighbor to practically establish a railway link with Syria's 2,450 kilometers railway network that extends to the Mediterranean Sea. With Iran and Iraq also planning to provide a vital connection between Kermanshah and Baghdad, pilgrims and other passengers from the two countries, as well as Syria and Lebanon, along with the flow of goods, can conveniently visit the holy sites in the three countries. The Islamic Republic of Iran, as the major railway powerhouse of West and Central Asia, is ideally located as the land bridge for the countries of the region, especially for the landlocked states of Central Asia and the Caucasus. Plans are also underway to connect the Iranian railway to Armenia and Afghanistan in order to provide a safe and economical route for these two countries to the high seas and the international markets. Currently, some 33 million tons of goods and over 30 million passengers are transported annually by the rail transportation network of Iran, accounting for 12 and 15% of all transportation, respectively. Once the Iran-Iraq railway link is complete, the tonnage of goods and the number of passengers will significantly rise. Iran's Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, who signed the latest agreement with Iraq's Transportation Minister, Hossein al-Shibli, said the Shalamche-Basra project will be completed in the next 2 months. The sooner this is completed, the better for the two neighbors as well as for other countries, since in addition to the benefits for trade and economy, the Iran-Iraq railway link would greatly boost political ties, strengthen the security and safeguard the sovereignty and independence of the region by accelerating the pace of the coordinated drive for driving out the American occupiers and thwarting the unbridled terrorism of the illegal Zionist entity.
Midstream.
The date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat occupation forces from Iraq approaches supposedly within days now, Iraqis are still skeptical that the U.S. withdrawal from their country will be a real one. Who's to blame them when the first announced official date of the long goodbye was supposedly August 2021, as per the Trump administration? However, the deadline was simply ignored by the new Biden administration. In July, U.S. President Joe Biden and Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Qadhimi met in Washington and allegedly agreed to conclude the American combat mission in Iraq by December 31, 2021. That's 3 days from now. Really? They are just going to simply leave? Well, follow me a little. Let us see how the U.S. operates in Iraq to begin with. It is no secret that the U.S. had adopted a low-cost colonial system of ruling Iraq for almost 10 years now. U.S. warplanes were stationed at up to six former Iraqi air bases, becoming the principal enforcer of the occupation. U.S. troops were thinned out. By 2020, this job was done so skillfully that the U.S. presence in Iraq became almost invisible. Hold on, I said almost. Iraq was occupied by Western forces, but it looked like an independent nation with the U.S. installed president and executive branch. Kurdish areas in the north became virtual U.S.-run mini-states. The demented Daesh movement was totally stamped out by Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi and the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps. As a thank you, the Iranian military supremo in Iraq, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps al-Quds forces, was ordered murdered by President Trump. Deputy head of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, arose a martyr that day alongside his dear friend and comrade, Martyr Hashd Qasem Soleimani. This grave mistake turned the golden victory in Iraq promised by the American neocons into ashes, leaving Washington stuck deep in an ungovernable nation, yet still capable of defeating Daesh and then targeting its real enemy, the U.S. occupation forces scattered in Iraq. Faced by the threat of more resistance guerrilla warfare, Joe Biden's administration announced it would pull all remaining U.S. combat troops from Iraq, but leaving 2,500 behind for training and embassy security. Training is a bad joke. Iraq has been almost in constant war since 1980. Iraqis need loyalty, pride, and patriotism to be effective fighters. How did I know? Here's a hint. Take a look at how Hashd al-Shaabi operates and you'll realize what the Iraqi army is missing. Who needs training from the armed forces that got whipped in Vietnam and now in Afghanistan? Iraq needs a real national government rather than foreign agents in Baghdad. Which is basically why, my friends, the U.S. will not withdraw from Iraq. It might change the name of its combat forces, but an occupation will always be an occupation, with resistance being its only form of elimination. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. As the date of the withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq approaches by the end of 2021, Iraqis remain skeptical about whether the withdrawal is real or just on paper. In July, the United States and Iraq held a strategic dialogue session during which the two countries agreed on withdrawing all U.S. combat troops from Iraq by December 31st of this year. Now, Tahsin al-Khafaji, spokesman of the Iraqi Joint Operations Command, had announced last month that most of the combat forces left Iraq and only advisors and those working in the field of intelligence, investigation, and training remained, reiterating that they will leave within 15 days. However, Iraqis fear that there might be no real withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, neither now after the 15 days have actually passed, nor in the upcoming new year. Rather, as many of the observers believe, there will be only a change in the name of these forces. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Al-Basra in Iraq is Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Al-Madhoush. It's a pleasure having you on our show. Now, it seems that the question of the century is, will the U.S. really pull out of its of Iraq with its occupation forces by the end of this year, or will it just hang in there and stay? They might chill. They have nothing to lose.
Ya Allah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. Thank you for hosting me on your show. Of course, as it's well known, especially to those who deal with American approach and behavior, they know that the Americans have great ambitions and intentions announced openly concerning their interests here in Iraq and the region. All this eruption and all this fallout and fragmentation and this great weakness and instability in the region is because none other than the US. America has reneged on covenants it had ratified with its own hands. Anyone with just little insight knows very well that if America comes out a door, it re-enters through a wider one and changes colors like a chameleon using painful methods. Undoubtedly, the US cannot leave this region as it views it as spoils of war par excellence.
Well, Ms. Ali, according to the agreement between Baghdad and Washington, the American forces will keep personnel for, and I quote here, consulting, training, equipment, or equipping, and exchanging intelligence information, I don't know with whom, but that's what they're saying. Now, who's to say that the U.S. won't keep all of its forces, but simply just change their name on paper, or maybe move the combat forces to Syria at a close range from Iraq at all times?
I totally agree with you. It was agreed and approved by Iraqi law and voted on by the Iraqi parliament that no foreign military presence will be allowed in Iraq after December 31, 2021, which is the last legal day for the U.S. presence inside Iraq. However, we know there's a lot of maneuvering and a lot of getting around this decision. In fact, I tell you that there are those inside Iraq who do not want America to leave, unfortunately. The order of the occupation forces to remain is not dependent on America as much as it's dependent on the interests of the certain Iraqi employers of foreign forces. It's humiliating, to be honest with you, how hard they fight to make sure the Americans remain here, crouching on the chest of the Iraqis and the region. There are many measures that America has put in place regarding the neighboring periphery, such as the border with Al-Bukamal and the border with the western region of Iraq. There is also the U.S. Embassy, which contains the largest military base in which America uses advanced defense equipment to protect, as if it wants to stay forever. We agree with you that there is a maneuver that America has prepared for. We are sure that the U.S. forces' exit will only happen on paper, but the truth remains and they cannot change it.
Ms. Ali, Iraqi political groups have called the formation of an alliance to expel American troops from the Arab country, from Iraq, when their mandate finishes by the end of this year, stating that Washington's attempts to prolong the presence of its occupation forces must never be taken into consideration. Do you think that is actually a viable option in case Washington proves to be actually dodging the withdrawal date? Do you think that fighting it out is the option?
It's well known that the Iraqi resistance factions, represented today by the popular mobilization forces, have become deterrent forces against the American entity and the usurping Israeli entity. This resistance has formed an equation of balance of forces. It's the resistance alliance that hurt the Americans and has become a striking tool for restoring rights and limiting the role of the Americans in the region. Today, the Iraqi government and its institutions and the Iraqi regular army undoubtedly have many U.S.-imposed restrictions and many strict measures as they cannot proceed with the process of extracting the Iraqi right. We have harnessed a great experience in fighting the American forces after the U.S. invasion. The U.S. occupation has suffered many hard blows by the Iraqi resistance factions. Undoubtedly, America is determined and waiting for the moment when law, Sharia, custom and humanity justify for us to expel the occupier from our country, especially against an occupation that breaks all laws. So basically, after December 31, Iraq turns into an occupied country, and all occupied countries have the full right to defend their lands and stand in the face of the invaders. May God give more strength to the Iraqi resistance factions. It always does what it vows to do. The U.S. occupation is always on high alert because of the severity of the resistance valor. The awareness of its leaders and its bases that have experienced war for years now, fighting and eliminating Daesh is an example.
Well, Ms. Ali, we know by heart by now how the U.S. operates when it desires to change reality on the ground, especially in Iraq. We might witness a sharp escalation of chaos, of tensions within the coming weeks as part of efforts to drive U.S. Forces to stay further inside of the country under the pretext of maintaining security inside of Iraq. How do you think the Iraqi resistance forces will react to such a possible scenario?
It is no secret for everyone who follows the American dirty politics that it plays bad roles in its cultural war, its media war, its software, its policy of containment, its policy of interfering in internal affairs and imposing its influence by different means and under many pretexts. Today, many countries fall for American lies, such as Saudi Arabia and others, who are deluded into the existence of the illusion of an enemy represented by the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to create an excuse to sell weapons and maintain their forces and interests in West Asia. Therefore, America will create many crises inside Iraq, but the conscious, the knowledgeable, the people of politics and those who are aware are following and monitoring this phenomenon. Today, we see that the signs of Americans' embrace of some factions and its sponsorship of some parties have begun to create an unstable and abnormal situation that will place Iraq on a hot plate. Signs of these movements started from the American support for some factions and forces in order to provoke instability that will lead all Iraqi blocs to turn to other external forces to take care of Iraq and get it out of this predicament. Today, the political tensions is evident under the auspices of America and its great intervention by changing the rules of the game. But the resistance forces and factions are conscious and want to miss the U.S. opportunity to invade. Today in Iraq, both wisdom and strength are present to confront America using its own tools.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Al-Madhoush, expert in international relations and political commentator, for joining us from Al-Basra, Iraq. It's a pleasure to have you on our show. And please now stay tuned, because next we will be talking about what options does the Iraqi resistance have to try and push the occupation out of Iraq.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Prior to Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi's visit to the United States, the New York Times described the new agreement to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq as nothing but a diplomatic play, while Sabrin News, channel affiliated with the Popular Mobilization Forces, criticized the agreement, saying that no American soldier will be withdrawn, their role will only be changed on paper. Why is this agreement seen as a theatrical show? Well, a number of pro-U.S. Iraqi leaders do not want to see the United States completely withdrawing from Iraq. These officials propagate that the U.S. actually supports a stable and friendly Iraq, while asserting every chance they get that a long-term U.S. presence, although maintains American influence in Iraq, however, it will help them mitigate Iranian, Russian, and other forms of what the U.S. refers to as malign influence. Funny how other states that enjoy normal diplomatic non-military ties with Iraq are viewed as maligned by the U.S., while its own forces of occupation is praised as friendship. On second thought, no, it's not funny, it's actually sick. Will the U.S. ever leave Iraq? More in this following report.
Ever since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, it was required of the U.S. occupation to exploit Iraq within a strategy that affects the entire region. However, in recent months, the so-called strategic dialogue between Baghdad and Washington, which set a time frame for the withdrawal of American forces and whose sessions took place under the threats and strikes of the Iraqi resistance led by factions of the Hashd al-Shaabi, gave many indications of how Iraq has turned from an imminent American threat against the axis of resistance in the early post-invasion stages to a threat against the presence of American occupation forces as part of this same axis. And if Iraq's positioning in the U.S. strategy was mainly related to striking the centers of power supporting the resistance movements between Lebanon and occupied Palestine, that is Syria and Iran, while making Iraq the center of an active American presence in the region, then the reality that American policy has reached does not only indicate a failure in that particular goal, but rather exceeds it to with a failure within Iraq itself. It was not required to isolate Iraq during the invasion stage from the ongoing state of conflict with the Israeli occupation entity, because it was already outside that conflict. Rather, what was required of Iraq was to be used to isolate and neutralize Syria and Iran, and then attack later on the resistance factions. However, in the years following the invasion, Washington's calculations collided with the transformations witnessed in the Iraqi arena. Iraq itself turned into a popular military and security offshoot for different resistance factions in West Asia and indeed has become among its deterrent force. In recent months, Iraqi resistance factions affiliated with the popular mobilization Hashd al-Shaabi announced that they had entered the deterrence equation regarding Al-Quds, which was announced by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, considering that violating Al-Quds equals a regional war. This particular part expresses the transformation inside Iraq, which the United States has always been trying to prevent. This was clearly demonstrated in the report of the Israeli National Security Institute at the end of last year, considering that the Zionist front in any upcoming war will be attacked with thousands of missiles, including dozens of precision missiles and armed drones from several arenas in parallel, from Lebanon, Syria, Western Iraq, and probably Gaza as well. The American military and political presence in Iraq is now threatened by the Hashd al-Shaabi forces, and things could spiral towards a military escalation if the United States tries to circumvent the promises of its withdrawal at a time when the latter seems unable to enter into an open war. This development was never by chance. Washington was seeking to place Iraq on the map of confronting Syria and Iran, but the resistance axis was aware of the danger of the American scheme leading the axis to embrace Iraqi resistance forces in the post-occupation stage. This kept the American tactic trapped inside the Iraqi arena and transferred it from a strategy of dismantling Syria and Iran outside Iraq to a practical path of dismantling its own military occupation bases inside of it due to the threats of the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi. Now to discuss this issue with us from Stockholm is Mr. Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Firas. Now, the top U.S. commander of the Middle East, his name is General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, he said last week that the United States will keep the current 2,500 troops inside of Iraq for what he said is the foreseeable future. So they're not leaving after all. So why all this propaganda of them leaving when they're not?
Well, I think it's business as usual for the Americans. They're trying to confuse the Iraqi people by conveying different type of information in this regard. Sometimes they say they're going to leave. Sometimes they say we have to make a deal first. And mostly they say we're not going to leave. We're changing the status, the title of the troops in Iraq from combating troops to advisors. But regardless of what they call them, they're only playing with words and counting on time. But no one in Iraq is interested, and especially not the resistance, to play any war feud games with them. They're going to stay. What I think is that the Americans don't have the intention to leave Iraq. They have to be forced out of Iraq, because they have invested a lot of money in Iraq, and they've invested and built the biggest embassy in the world in Baghdad, second to the one that's going to come up in Beirut. And they have a military camp in the embassy, the Union 3 camp. So there's a reason for them to resist being forced out from Iraq. But I think this method that they're using by wasting time, counting on time, and trying to confuse people won't work, because they think that people will forget the occupation and go on. But it won't work, because the Iraqi people, especially after the assassination in January last year, have changed, and the tide has changed against the United States of America.
Well, Firas, basically, despite the so-called shift by U.S. forces to a non-combat role in Iraq, they said clearly that they will still provide air support and other military aid for Iraq's fight against Daesh terrorist groups. Now, hold on a second there, because the entire globe already knows who bred, funded, and trained Daesh in Iraq and Syria. And for the love of God, I mean, America killed the two most prominent commanders in West Asia who actually fought and eliminated Daesh. And I'm talking about Martyr Soleimani and Martyr Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. How come the Iraqi population is just okay with this? They continue with their lives when they are being played by the United States of America.
I don't think generally people in Iraq are okay with this. The Iraqi people has a lot of grievances, of course, and the Americans are making them bigger to just to adjust the time so they can still go on and be have a presence in Iraq. But the title that they're giving to their forces, advisor, that's only a title. The Americans has already acted in Iraq since they came back in 2014 as landlords, and they will continue to do so as long as they are in Iraq. They have not heeded to the agreement they had with the Iraqi government since 2014, and they've acted by they've controlled the Iraqi airspace totally, and they've dealt with the Iraqi resistance forces and Hashd al-Shaabi, which is basically part of the Defense Department in Iraq, as terrorists sometimes. And you have the unexpected visit of Trump to Ayn al-Assad, which the Iraqi government didn't know of, and actually in the assassination of the commander of the leaders of the victory leaders, as you mentioned, the Americans used more drones in Iraqi airspace in that operation than what they are allowed to in their deal with the Iraqi government. So no Iraqi accept their presence in Iraq if they don't have any personal benefit. But I would say most Iraqis despise the Americans, because they remember that most of their problems from the ascending of the Ba'ath Party was because of U.S. interference in Iraq. They have not forgotten that the United States of America imposed two wars on Iraq. They forced the Iraqi government in eight years war with Iran, and they put sanctions on the Iraqi people that killed more than half a million Iraqi children. The Secretary of State in the United States at that time, Albright, said that this is a price worth to pay, and the Iraqis remember this. And actually, it was the Iraqi people's representatives in the parliament who voted to expel the U.S. troops. So the political situation in Iraq is a mess sometimes, but this vote in the parliament is historic, because it shows how big the disapprovement of the U.S. forces in Iraq are.
So basically, the U.S. will try to delay its withdrawal, just as you said, to suggest that it actually has the upper hand in where it goes with its troops, instead of actually being compelled to be kicked out of Iraq and withdraw. But the Iraqi resistance seemingly has a very different plan for the U.S. occupation forces. How do you see the upcoming year in Iraq, knowing that the U.S. has never stood by its declarations and agreements when it comes to any area that it occupies?
The Iraqi resistance have been very clear about the issue. They have given the Americans a deadline, but until the 31st of December this year, New Year's Eve, to leave. And if they don't leave, they will be counted as occupation forces and dealt by that. But remember again that the resistance forces have not been idle since the assassination and the vote in parliament last year. They have notified the Americans from now and then about their presence and which type of resistance they will be forced with if they stay in Iraq. They have attacked a lot of logistical support for the U.S. forces in Iraq. It could sound like small acts, but we have to remember that targeted items are not cheap. It's state-of-art military equipment that costs $100 billion maybe. So the Americans have felt the pain, and it's obvious because the Iraqi government, which Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi leads now, has ordered Iraqi soldiers to go out and patrol those streets that the U.S. logistical support passed by to ensure their safety. But it hasn't been successful. It has been in vain. So the resistance is clever, and they have managed to continue their attacks. One of the resistance forces, Qatar Sayyid al-Shuhada, actually opened the doors for volunteers to fight the Americans if they stay after New Year's Eve. And just a couple of days, three or four days after they opened the window for that, they have to close it because they got more than 50,000 volunteers who are ready to fight the Americans if they're going to stay in Iraq.
So basically, Iraq is looking at a very tense upcoming new year in the event the Americans remain, but we have faith that the Iraqi resistance has the upper hand in Iraq. And I want to thank you very much, Mr. Firas Ali, for joining us to talk about this issue from Stockholm as a political commentator. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can then tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. The article you're about to hear has been published by the New York Times opinion section. The article has been written by Benjamin Applebaum, the lead writer on economics and business for the New York Times editorial board. The piece is titled, "The Rotten Core of the Republican Party." Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, recently took to social media to warn that Democrats have hatched a dastardly plot. Democrats, he said, want to track every penny you earn so they can tax you and your family at the maximum possible amount. Well, yes, Democrats want Americans to pay the full amount they owe in taxes. What doesn't get enough attention is that many Republicans seem not to agree. Resistance to taxation is the rotten core of the modern Republican Party. Republicans in recent decades have sharply reduced the federal income tax rates imposed on wealthy people and big companies. But their opposition to taxation goes beyond that. They are actively aiding and abetting tax evasion. Republicans have hacked away at funding for the Inland Revenue Service, the IRS, over the past decade, enfeebling the agency. When the rich and powerful open loopholes in the tax code, Republicans reliably fight to keep the loopholes open. Indeed, they valorize Americans who find ways to pay less, a normalization of antisocial behavior that may be even more damaging than the efforts at bureaucratic sabotage. Former President Donald Trump's loud and proud declaration that paying very little in taxes makes me smart was just a more brazen articulation of what has become party orthodoxy. The Democratic proposal targeted by Kevin McCarthy in the video he posted online, he actually calls it un-American, would make it harder for wealthy people to cheat on their taxes. The Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, estimated in 2019 that Americans conceal from taxation more than half of income that is not subject to some form of third-party verification, like a W-2, the form that the government uses to verify ordinary wage income. This blind spot costs the federal government hundreds of billions of dollars in unpaid taxes. In comparison, more than 95% of wage income is reported. Under the current version of the Democrats' plan, which is part of the Biden administration's sweeping Build Back Better legislation, banks would be required to submit annual reports on accounts with total inflows and outflows exceeding $10,000, excluding paychecks and government benefits. The banks would report the total amount deposited in the account and the total amount withdrawn. There would be no reporting of individual transactions. The information would give the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, a better chance to catch cheaters, and it would provide a salutary reminder for people to pay what they owe. The Biden administration recently cemented an international agreement to establish a 15% global minimum tax on corporate income. The long-sought deal would reduce the incentive for American firms to evade taxation by pretending to generate revenue in low-tax havens like Ireland and roughly half of the islands in the Caribbean, a practice that has become all but business as usual in industries with intangible products, like finance, technology, and pharmaceutical research. The minimum corporate tax, like the bank reporting requirement, is not aimed at increasing what is owed. It is aimed at collecting what is owed already. Improving tax collection was another important benefit. Democracy and capitalism rest on a lacework of mutual obligation. People fulfill their own responsibilities because they're confident others will too. Collecting taxes, especially from the rich and powerful, is an affirmation of that faith. Felicia Wong, the president of the Roosevelt Institute, a progressive think tank based in New York, said that the corporate tax agreement, which includes 136 countries, is valuable as a demonstration that governments have the ability to impose their will on multinational corporations in the service of the public interest. A hopeful model for confronting other problems like climate change. It can and should create more faith in governance, she said. Both plans, however, must overcome the united opposition of congressional Republicans. The Republican Party was reborn in the 1970s under the banner of resistance to taxation, led by anti-tax men like Jack Kemp and Ronald Reagan. It remains the party's fixation, the one major area of policy on which congressional Republicans were able to agree upon during the Trump administration. By way of ideological justification, Republicans like to talk about liberty, by which they mean a narrow and negative kind of freedom from civic duty and mutual obligation. But the fervent opposition to taxation has always found its deeper wellsprings of motivation in concern about how the money will be spent. In the bellwether case of California, the rise of anti-tax activism was inextricably intertwined with the decline of a white electoral majority. It wasn't a question of whether Americans should ever be required to help one another. The real question was, who would be helped? Opposition to progressive income taxation also draws strength from an imagined democratic ideal in which the people who vote for taxation, pay the taxes, and get the benefits are all one and the same. History tells a very different story, though. From the outset, taxation in the United States was designed as an antidote to inequality. The government initially chose to raise revenue through tariffs, collecting from wealthy merchants. The introduction of a federal income tax in the early 20th century was a different means to the same end. In a historical analysis published last year, a pair of German political scientists, Laura Zielkopf and Hannah Leeser, showed that progressive taxation is a hallmark of democratic governance. Political philosophers have long fretted that democracy allows the poor to plunder the rich. Your opposite has proved more nearly true. Progressive taxation is not a threat to the wealthy. It is a small price to pay for prosperity. Cutting taxes to staff social programs is, by itself, a threat to the sustainability of the American experiment in multicultural democracy. In enabling resistance to lawful taxation, Republicans are engaged in an even more direct assault on democracy. Having failed to constrain government spending through the democratic process, they are seeking to undermine government itself. Representative Kevin McCarthy is right to frame a fairly technical change in tax rules as an issue that goes to the heart of American democracy. Democracies impose higher taxes than other forms of government because democracies are communities of common purpose. We create and maintain our society through our contributions. Or we don't, and things fall apart.
Lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new face was put to Iran after its June the 18th presidential elections. The results were anticipated in 2019 and materialized in 2021. Participation was under 50%, but over 61% of ballots were cast in Ayatollah Raisi's name. Now, with every new president come new dilemmas, decisions, and results. These we'll be covering in Iran Today's Year-Ender episode today with me, Leila Faramarzi, so do stay tuned.
Ebrahim Raisi inherited an important agenda, which is the Vienna talks for sanctions removal of Iran, and a big crisis, which is the corona pandemic with its many names and strains. Also, Iran's media and IT apparatus is blocked every so often. Now, to take a look at the elections that passed and the three issues Iran faces, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, for the next 25 minutes or so.
Iran's elections were the subject of much talk, as they generally have been for the past decade. Some Iranians had said they were not 100% sure they would participate in the elections at all because they were suffering an unjustified economic hardship. For this, I had a chat with Mr. Mohammad Reza Shojaian of Jame Jam Daily for a media man's take on election results.
There has been a gray spectrum. People who said they were not going to vote, but at the last moment went to the ballots. What I'm saying is that it could be regarded as a component of democracy in the country, because we have a wide range of different thoughts and ideologies in the country. Since our nation isn't ruled by a totalitarian system, as some falsely advertise against the Islamic Republic of Iran, people have the right to vote. We have been given this right. No one went to the ballots at knife point. We must pay attention to that.
Question is, basically, how did Raisi get to win? This I put to Mr. Naghavi, a former MP whom we always interviewed as an articulate political analyst. He received us at his electoral station from where he'd been campaigning to encourage voter participation.
Mr. Raisi was distinct among the seven presidential candidates. One can say that he had a clear advantage over the group. That's because the two reformist candidates, Mr. Mehrizadeh and Hemmati, weren't even endorsed by the reformists. This caused them not to have any motivation to engage in the competition or go to the polls. Or, for example, Mr. Hemmati was considered a low-tier candidate of the executives of Construction Party. Among the principalists, also Mr. Ghazizadeh, Zakani and Jalili were closer to a possible presidency. But Mr. Raisi was head and shoulders above them in terms of his experience and background.
The 13th presidential election was held simultaneously with the 6th city and village council elections, midterm elections for the 5th assembly of experts, and midterm elections for the 11th parliament. City and village council elections were held with electronic ballot boxes in the capitals of 24 provinces, but not in Tehran.
The simple fact is that we didn't have the excitement we witnessed in the elections of 2017, 2013, 2005 or 1997. The excitement in those elections was tremendous. The turnout was over 70-80%, but this was a good election in its own right. About 48% of the eligible voters participated, which isn't unacceptable compared to other democratic systems. Although the elections are always filled with excitement and have 70-80% turnouts, 48% isn't too satisfactory for our people. But it's a good figure compared to other democratic systems.
Mr. Raisi said he wanted to be leader to the whole nation, left or right, young or old, while fighting the economic corruptions. I asked how realistic his presidential mottos had been.
You know, he spent all his life fighting corruption. He was a judge for many, many years. And that was the main theme of his election campaign. So he would want to do some of the promises that he made. And this is going to be something that he would be interested in engaging in. You know, they come, these clerics like him, come from that liberation theology school of thought that started the Islamic Revolution. Clerics that believe they have a role in society, they need to take care of the poor, they need to have social programs.
The past 3 years have been an unmatched time in Iranian politics. A principalist atmosphere started taking over the Iranian political sphere. Although Mr. Raisi ran for president as an independent, he was appointed chief of judiciary as a principalist in 2019. Next, the legislature or parliament's majority was won by principalists in 2020. And the same Mr. Raisi moved to the executive in 2021. The judiciary is also headed by a well-known principalist figure, Ghulam Hossein Ejei, although the judiciary is generally principalist.
Now, when it comes to national interest-related decisions on whether to compromise or not to compromise, methods and people may change, but the goals and framework remain intact. Political senior figures in this country tend to agree on this, and President Raisi pledged to get sanctions lifted off this country, just as he pledged to improve relations with neighbors.
Raisi, being a principalist, he's been expected to take a harder stance in determining U.S. good faith and actual sanctions relief. The JCPOA-related sanctions removal Vienna talks began in April, and they are still ongoing with short intervals every now and then.
Addressing the Supreme Council of the Ministry of Defense of the Russian Federation, Russian President Vladimir Putin made some very practical and important remarks. He said the Americans easily withdraw from any deal without providing any explanation, answer, or reasoning for their moves. To quote Mr. Putin, he said, "That's why we demand legally binding commitments and guarantees from the U.S. that the current expansion of NATO along our eastern borders does not continue." So, when the Russian president believes that the U.S. is not committed to any deal and easily exits them, it shows that the Islamic Republic of Iran is taking the correct stance.
The United States began passing laws in breach of the JCPOA right after its signing. May the 8th, 2018 is the day Donald Trump binned the deal and accused Iran of lying about its commitments. Just the following day, the International Nuclear Watchdog Chief noted again that Iran is meeting the terms of the agreement. Even the then U.S. Secretary of State himself, Mike Pompeo, admitted that there was no evidence Iran was in violation of the agreement. It bears the conclusion there was no legitimate basis for Trump to pull out and reimpose sanctions on this country.
As a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency, we volunteered to sign a safeguard deal with the IAEA. All our nuclear activities have been peaceful, and we've done our utmost to cooperate on the issue so we can secure our legal rights. We don't allow the other side to make excessive demands. During the course of the talks, the Islamic Republic's proposals to the Western side have convinced the other P4 plus 1 negotiators that Iran will not give up its rights.
Thing is, Iran signed the 2015 nuclear deal, or JCPOA, with six world powers to get UN economic-related sanctions lifted off this country to boost its economy and oil sales. In return, Iran was to limit its nuclear program. This it did. But former U.S. President Donald Trump still unilaterally, and most would say illegally, pulled out of the JCPOA and reimposed and reinforced the sanctions on Iran, now as U.S. sanctions.
Iran even waited a year for Europeans to execute a way around what was now U.S. sanctions, but to no avail.
The insistence of Iran's new negotiating team and the talks that have been held has made other teams align their positions with Iran. Over 80% of the proposals the Iranian side has put forward has been or have been taken into consideration despite the sabotage attempts from the three European signatories, especially France. Iran's demands have lifted those pressures and now the outlook looks promising. God willing, the course of the deal will end in a result that will serve the Iranian nation's interests.
Why would you say the Vienna talks and sanctions removal have taken so long, apart from the factors you said?
The talks have taken this long because we've been making preparations. There have been changes in the course of the negotiations. The European side has realized that if pressure mounts on the Islamic Republic, it will strengthen its regional agenda. Iran has ramped up uranium enrichment within the framework of the Parliament's resolution and the safeguard agreements it has with the IAEA. If Europe applies any pressure, Iran will continue doing that. That's why they've started giving concessions so that, God willing, a good deal that will be in our national interest will be reached.
Iran started to partially reduce its commitments to the JCPOA in 2019 in accordance with paragraph 36 of the multilateral agreement. Paragraph 36 allows one side to stop complying with the deal if the other side is out of compliance. If sanctions are lifted, Iran will immediately reverse its decisions and enhancing its nuclear program.
The claim that some political camps wanted to declare themselves the winners is totally false and entirely for journalistic effects. The fact that we've been able to win concessions from the Western side is because our diplomacy is becoming balanced. The previous administration's diplomacy excessively considered the West. We weren't using the opportunities our neighbors provided us. But as you see, in the 115 days since the 13th administration in Iran has taken office, Iran's diplomacy has changed based on the principles of dignity, wisdom, and expediency, and took Iran out of the path towards isolation.
Looking at things as they are, Iran has actually gained strategic depth in deepening its partnership with Russia and China. It is neither exactly possible now to isolate Iran nor prudent to exercise the military option against it.
Our strategic allies such as the Russian Federation and China are actively supporting Iran. Over the past 2 weeks, the Russian Foreign Ministry has officially stated that the U.S. must provide guarantees and compensation to Iran. This convergence and the atmosphere of coalition building that Iran has created will lead the United States to change its game. Sometimes the Americans who created Israel and are behind all these incidents prefer balanced measures because the Islamic Republic has warned that in case the agreement falls apart, any adventurous measures or threat against Iran will threaten the entirety of U.S. interests.
Thus far, Israel has been provoking Western parties to the JCPOA, winning points for itself, put Iran behind. Now, do you think this is going to continue, looking at how the talks are going so far?
Certainly Israel will not abandon its hostility to Iran and will use any means to upset the balance in the region. But the regime and those who will aid it will be defeated. The situation is becoming such that it's Israel that's being isolated. The warmongering that Israel is advocating both in the political sense with the JCPOA and the security threats and destructive actions is taken and continues to take will backfire. Israel has never been and won't ever be a force to threaten Iran. The actions it's taken have all been merely to cause annoyance.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. This series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
In the year that passed, that's 2021, like previous years, Iran suffered instances of Western media tyranny time and again. The most notable instance being the seizure of PressTV's.com domain. Several resistance-related media websites suffered the same. And recently, the UK imposed a ban on an Iranian journalist, a reporter, on claims of human rights violations.
The British government accused Ali Rezvani, who is an Iranian state media journalist for the popular and highly watched 2030 news program, of being involved in the interrogation of detainees and broadcasting their forced confessions, as well as spreading misinformation regarding political prisoners, dissidents, and hostages. In reaction to the move by the British government, IRIB head Peyman Jebelli commended Rezvani's media valour and said the illegal measure was indicative of the British monarchy's political idiocy. I express my felicitations to you on your media effort and valour that has made the arrogant British government angry and confused, Jebelli said in a statement. The imposition of sanctions on a journalist by a monarchy whose record over the past centuries has been riddled with human rights abuses means that it has morphed into a political idiot much more than what was previously thought. The allegations against the Iranian reporter come against the dismal backdrop by the British government to muzzle free speech and disregard for the rights of minorities, as well as helping totalitarian governments in other countries to suppress their people. In October 2018, the results of the report by the Equality and Human Rights Commission, EHRC, showed that around 14 million Britons with disabilities, roughly a fifth of the UK population that is, have suffered from erosion of their rights. The study, which reported its findings to the United Nations Committee on Disability Rights, said that there was deeply concerning evidence showing that the situation of the disabled people across the UK is getting worse, despite government pledges to improve their conditions. A report released last October by the British NGO Action